Thank you, Gary. There for a moment, I thought we were going to be treated to some revisionist history. It really is good to be here with you. My wife, Cynthia, and I consider it a privilege and an honor to make that trek, Brother Gary. You folks have been a tremendous blessing to many people, and certainly to us at Faith Builders and the ministry there. You've graciously allowed a number of your people to serve on different boards and councils with us. You have entrusted a number of your people to come as students. And the moral support that we felt from this congregation, this community, has been very, very significant for us. And so we say thank you for that. Now, I want to say right off the bat that I feel much more comfortable in the classroom than this kind of presentation. There's something that's just more personal about that, and we can interact. I get a better sense of where people are and what they're doing with what I'm saying. So, but this can't be a classroom, so that's okay. But I thought maybe just to relax myself a little bit, I'd put up a few pictures, give you a couple snapshots to of who I am, or at least some of the influences that went into making me me. I was born into an old Mennonite, and I'm using the technical term there, old Mennonite family. Dad was a minister in Southeastern Mennonite Conference. I think I'm about 1 year old here. We moved to South Carolina when I was seven, and I went to a public school from grades 2 through 8, and this is my fifth grade class. I don't know if you can pick me out or not. If not, I'm on the front row to right in here. I had two heroes growing up, Sitting Bull and Thomas Edison. Cynthia and I have been married almost 30 years now, and we have 5 children, and 2 of them are married. We also have 2 grandchildren, or actually 3 grandchildren. I know there's only 2 here, but that's what I had for you. And we've been at Faith Builders now for 18 years. In 2004, the day after Christmas, off the west coast of Sumatra, Indonesia, there was an earthquake, 9.1 on the Richter scale. This triggered a series of devastating tsunamis along the coasts of many of the land masses that bordered the Indian Ocean. And I'm sure many of you remember that tsunami. Now, a tsunami, as we know, is caused by a displacement, generally in the ocean floor, a displacement of water, and that displacement causes the water to move at a much higher rate than normal. But as the surge, or as this fast-moving water gets closer and closer to shore, the speed trades with height of water. And so while at the deep part of the ocean, the tsunami might be moving at, say, 500 miles per hour, when it gets closer to shore, it will slow down significantly, but the storm surge, the height of the water level, increases, and in some cases, significantly. The 2004 earthquake was over 100 feet high at places. Now, scientists have estimated the amount of energy that was released in this particular earthquake, And they give the estimate of around 5 megatons, 5 million tons of TNT. That's the amount of energy that was being released here. Now, that's not a 5 million tons of TNT doesn't do much for me. But fortunately, they put it in terms that I can connect with. And that is, they said to envision all of the explosives that were used during World War II, and including the two atomic bombs, one on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, take all of that, all of the bombs dropped by Germany, by the Allied forces, take the entire amount, multiply by two, and you still have less explosive energy present than what was present in this one tsunami. To give a picture of the force, this particular ship, a 2,600-ton ship, was flung over a mile inland by the tsunami. And they really couldn't figure out a good way to get it back to the ocean, so they just left it there, and you can now go visit it as a tourist attraction. 230,000 people were killed by that tsunami. The Apostle Paul writes in Romans 12 about another tsunami. Look for it. Oh, the depths of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor, or who has given a gift to him that he might be repaid? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen. Do you hear something of Paul just almost hyperventilating here about how great God is? And it's in this context that he goes on to say, I appeal to you because of the greatness of God. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God. What is good and acceptable and perfect. Now, the part I have in yellow is not the tsunami. But there's a tsunami here in this passage, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I first want to think about this phrase, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Everyone has a picture of what is good and acceptable and perfect. We live our lives by this picture. The kind of foods we eat, how to relate to our neighbors, what to do on Friday night. What kind of coffee is best? We have a picture of what is good, what is acceptable, and perfect. And this picture is our worldview. I'd like to define our worldview in a couple different ways. First of all, a few metaphors. I'm using the word worldview this evening to represent the way I understand the world. The way I make sense of the world. And so in that way, it's like a pair of glasses. It's the way that I interpret what I am looking at and what I'm seeing. A worldview can also be understood as the way I define what is normal. You see, as I go through life and as I encounter different people and different situations, I evaluate what I'm seeing, what I'm experiencing, and I make a judgment as to whether that's the way it ought to be or not. And it's my worldview that allows me to make those judgments. So in that sense, it's like a level that I use to say, is this normal or not? A more rigorous definition of worldview could be this, that a worldview is the set of head and heart commitments. That is, what I believe and value. We make commitments of belief, we make commitments of value, of love. And that set of commitments forms our worldview. When I was in fourth grade, one of my teachers was Mrs. Sears. Now, Mrs. Sears, she was a good teacher in many ways, but she had a habit. She smoked. And she smoked several times a day. So she gave us strict instructions. She didn't tell us what she was going to do, but she gave us strict instructions to, if she needed to be gone from the classroom, we were to continue our work without talking to each other. And she said, if I return and I hear you talking, the entire class will need to receive a licking. Now, a licking for Mrs. Sears was the genuine article. It meant that you put out your hand. You notice I'm not smiling about this. This is painful. You'd put out your hand, and she would come around. She had she called it a razor strap. It was a piece of rubber about this long, and she would come around, and it was three licks on everybody's hand. Well, on more than one occasion, someone was talking when she returned, and I remember when she was making her rounds, and she got to me, and my hand was out, but I said, Mrs. Sears, this isn't fair. She said, what are you talking about? I said, I wasn't talking. Why do I need to get a licking? And she fixed me with her stare, and she said, Stephen, the sooner you learn something that I'm going to tell you, the better you're going to get along in life. And it's this, that in this world, the good have to suffer with the bad. Now you see, Mrs. Sears, she had a commitment. She had a belief that she was living her life by, and she wanted to pass it on to me. Set of head and heart commitments. This is our worldview. So we talked about we have these beliefs about the way the world is. We also have things that we value. We might value gathering together as a community, as a church. We might value things like humility. And saying that, I'm remembering another one of my, actually this wasn't a teacher, this was a guest speaker at the public school. It was one of these motivational speakers, you know, that's rah-rah, gets you all excited. And he was, see, I grew up in a community, I'm sure, very much like this one, where we were taught, it's prideful to talk about your accomplishments and things like that. This man got up there, and this was his line. He said, students, I want you to know something, that if you don't blow your own horn, everybody else will use it for a trash can. Now, you see, that was memorable. I 40-some years later, that's locked in there. That was a value that this man had. So, beliefs and values, we have thousands of them. So it's a worldview is a set of head and heart commitments, what I believe and value about the way the world really is. And we could even add to that, it's about the way the world really is, but it's also about the way we think the world ought to be. That's part of this worldview. And I'll add one other thing that shapes what I do and how I do it. So underneath all of my activity, all of the kinds of things I'm involved in and how I'm involved in those things is this worldview, this set of beliefs and values. Every age has kind of a dominant worldview that's in the air that we breathe. Beliefs and values that are accepted almost without challenge. They're there. Now let me illustrate the effect of a worldview and how it shapes us. I understand that in some of the tribal groups in Turkey, if you wish to compliment a friend of yours who's just had a child, you know, and it's a young baby, and you're going down the street and you see your friend and they're pushing this baby in a stroller, and you take a look in the stroller and it's such a cute child, and you want to compliment the parents on, you know, on their achievement. What you do is you say, "Oh, your child looks like a donkey." Now, notice, this is what they're doing, and something they're complimenting the parents, and how they're doing it is by saying the opposite of what they intend. Now, why? Because they have a set of beliefs and values underneath that causes them to behave in that way. You see, in this understanding, in this worldview, the world is a place that is filled with all kinds of spirits. The air is full of spirits. And these spirits are just kind of around watching, looking for someone smiling, laughing, looking for someone that seems to be enjoying themselves, looking for someone that's happy. And if they find that, they say, "Oop, let's try to arrange something not so good." And so if you really care about your friend, you want to cloak your compliment in something that doesn't trigger these malevolent spirits to do something bad to your friend. Our worldview shapes what we do and how we do what we do. Now, I pick an illustration like that that's quite different from our own worldview, because we can much easier see sometimes the connection for others, but for ourselves, sometimes the connections are almost transparent. Now, back to Romans. He says, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good, acceptable, and perfect." Paul is outlining a path for how our worldviews can align with God's, with how our set of beliefs and values actually are in alignment with that which is truly good, acceptable, and perfect. The way things genuinely are. And Paul says the path for that is a renewed mind. It's going to take, our minds are going to have to adapt to come into alignment with the way things really are. Now, I said there was a tsunami here in this passage, and now we're ready for that. The tsunami is right here. The obstacle to this renewed mind, to a worldview that is in alignment with what is genuinely true, is the conforming power of the worldview of this age. And I'm using the illustration of a tsunami for us to think about how powerful that really is. Just as a tsunami is a powerful force that overwhelms all in its path, so the worldview of this age has incredible power to shape our worldviews. Do not be conformed to the worldview of this age, Paul says. Don't allow your worldview to be a copy of the worldview that happens to be in vogue. Don't let the understanding of what is good and worthwhile be pressed on you by the dominant culture. But the dominant culture is an incredibly powerful force. And it is shaping the worldview of this generation. It's shaping you. It's shaping me. It's shaping our children. This is the default. What is in the air is going to shape us. This is what will happen if we do nothing. This is the tsunami, and it overwhelms any kind of half-hearted efforts to oppose it. Let me illustrate. The proportion of Americans who favor gay marriage has increased by 28 percentage points from 1996 to 2015. The Americans who think premarital sex is wrong has changed from around 75% in 1969 to around 35% in 1980. That's a tsunami. That is amazing in terms of changing the perspective, the beliefs and values of a people. There is, and has always been, since man has rebelled, a moral pressure to accept evil as good, false statements as true. The specifics change, but the Antichrist stance represented by the spirit of the age remains. So, where are we headed this weekend? I've entitled this series, Anabaptism as Worldview, because that's the approach we're taking about thinking about this understanding of what it means to follow Christ called Anabaptism. In this first session, what I want to do is think together a bit more about the worldview of this age and give three dominant characteristics. What are some of the core beliefs that are in the air that are shaping us? In sessions 2 and 3, I want to frame the discussion, including I want to think about how about the question, why should we be spend this weekend talking about Anabaptism rather than Christianity? And it's not that the two are that separable, but I'm just going to put the question out there that way. So, and when I say sessions, I'm planning on session 1 and 2 this evening, and then tomorrow evening, 3 and 4. But sessions 4 through 8 then, I plan to give 6 words that describe the Anabaptist Christian worldview, how it is that some of the core beliefs and values of Anabaptism. So in this session, the worldview of this age, what are some of the beliefs and values that seem to have almost universal acceptance? I want to develop 3 here, and we're going to develop them by looking at 3 questions, 3 fundamental questions. The first one is the question of reality. What is? Because every worldview answers this question. What is? What exists? What is significant? What endures? What is trustworthy? That's all part of this question. The second question we're going to look at is the question of truth. Does truth exist? And if truth does exist, can we know it? Do we have access to it? A second huge component of our worldview. And a third question, the question of goodness. What is truly worthwhile? What is truly good? What is the good life? What is worth pursuing in life? Every worldview answers these 3 questions, and I'd like to just paint the picture of what's in the air today in response to these 3 questions. And I plan to do that for each one by telling a story that's out there, and then tease the out of that story something of the answer that the dominant culture gives. So first, this question of reality. What is? What has ultimate significance? To help us think about how the worldview of this age answers this question, I want to read from a children's storybook, and those of you who've been in my class, you may have remembered me reading this there, but it's from Berenstain Bears. The Berenstain Bears Nature Guide. Come, the wonders of nature await you outside with me, Papa Bear, as your nature walk guide. In all my years as a nature guide, I've followed one rule far and wide. Be alert for any sign or sound. The wonders of nature are all around. Yipe! Now there's a wonder of nature not many have seen. Wow, Papa Bear, we see what you mean. Ah, yes, nature is happening every minute, and some of us get very caught up in it. Now I'm going to break into the story for a moment. Remember the question. The question is, what is, what exists, what is real? What is nature? It's everybody and everything. A peacock's tail, a butterfly's wing. It's snails and stones and dinosaur bones, volcanoes, earthquakes. Cousin Liz, that's just a part of what nature is. Nature is the world of animals, from the biggest whale to the smallest flea. It's the world of plants, from the tiniest weed to the tallest tree. It's the earth itself, the rocks and soil, and from under the earth come coal and oil. So far, not too bad. Nature is every person, thing, and place, here on earth and out in space. Nature's the sun, the moon, the stars, its faraway planets like Venus and Mars. It's the mountains, the valleys, the shore, the sea. Nature is you. Nature is me. And then, it's all that is, or was, or ever will be. So right here, embedded in this children's storybook, is an answer to the question, what is real? And it says, the only thing that's real is the physical, is the material. What is? The worldview of this age says the physical is all there is. There is no God. There is no hereafter. All we have is the moment. And science and technology, since they deal with the physical, are our best hopes for solving the world's problem. We call this perspective naturalism, naturism. I quote from one of the most famous scientists of our times, Francis Crick. You, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. You get that? You're nothing but a brain and the chemical reactions that are taking place there. That's all there is. Naturalism tells us there is no soul, there is only body. There is no mind, there's only brain. There is no God, there are only atoms. A friend of mine grew up in an Anabaptist, conservative Anabaptist home, spent 4 years in a secular college studying not philosophy, not biology, not psychology, studying music. And he told me, he was taking classes in Canada where you don't have to take psychology and philosophy and biology, that normally the classes we think of that will challenge the faith of believers. And he said, I really thought I was prepared for college. And he said, really, I did not have a single class that challenged my faith. He said, all the classes I took were in music, and it was, you know, music composition and so on and so forth. And so he said, I was really shocked when in the fourth year of my program, I'm sitting in a music class, and my mind is drifting, and I realize that the non-existence of God is a very real possibility in my mind. The non-existence of God all of a sudden made sense to him. Why? Because that's in the air. It's the worldview of this age. And it's, we absorb it even if it isn't always said. What is? The physical. And that's all. According to the worldview of this age. The second question we said is the question of, does truth exist? And this one, to develop it, I'm going to do it in two stages. And I'm going to use a little golden book. Everybody loves little golden books. Now, this is the little golden book of prayers. And as we turn to the first page, we see a nice picture of children surrounded by a familiar psalm, "Make a joyful noise to the Lord." And we also notice the symbols of different world faiths. And then in the foreword, we read, among other things, that there are many ways of praying. And we go on. We find a prayer from the Psalms next to a Hindu prayer from the Bhagavad Gita, next to a Buddhist prayer, a Jewish prayer, a Muslim prayer. And we see the Lord's Prayer right next to a Hindu prayer that includes the line, "I am in every religion." The book concludes with a poem. "This I know, in heaven above, all hope and joy are there. In the circle of his love, there's room for awe and despair." And while we agree, the implication is quite different than what we believe. Does truth exist? The not so subtle message of this book is that all religions are reliable guides to truth. But the reason that that perspective so makes so much sense in the West today, and that's a more of an Eastern perspective, the reason that this perspective is part of the air that we breathe is because of something different. In the words of Alan Bloom, "There is one thing a professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering the university believes or says he believes that truth is relative." John Leo, writing in the U.S. News and World Report about a professor that he knows, says that more and more students are unwilling to say that what Hitler did in killing millions of Jews is wrong. Usually they say, "Oh, we deplore what they did," but they express their disapproval in terms of personal taste, not in moral judgment. "Of course I dislike the Nazis," one student was quoted as saying, "but who is to say that they're morally wrong?" John Leo tells of another professor who says that she can't get a majority of her students to say that human sacrifice is universally wrong. She said 30 years ago, that was no problem. Today, I can get almost no one to say that. When one student was asked what they thought, they said, "I really don't know about human sacrifice. You know, if it's done as part of a religion of long standing, it's been around for a while, then maybe it's okay." Does truth exist? Can we know it? The answer that the worldview of this age gives is nothing is universally true. We call that relativism. Relativism says, in the words of William Provine, another eminent scientist, "No inherent moral or ethical laws exist, nor are there absolute guiding principles for human society. The universe cares nothing for us, and we have no ultimate meaning in life." And since there are no universally true answers to the foundational questions, then find answers that are satisfying for you. Respect others, the answers that they find as equally valid. Be tolerant. Be respectful. Don't make universal claims like Jesus is the only way to God. If Jesus works for you, that's wonderful. That's neat. I'd like to hear the story sometime. Just don't insist that it's what I need. Is there truth? The only truth is what I create. That's the spirit of the age. The third question, what is truly good? What's worth living for? What's worthwhile? And the story here comes from Eckhart Tolle, considered to be one of the great theologians of this time. I believe Oprah Winfrey has popularized Eckhart Tolle and his theology. He's a self-described theologian. I believe it's Time Magazine or there's some periodicals that have named Eckhart Tolle as the most spiritually influential person in the world today. He's the one that tells this story. He says there was a beggar sitting by the side of the road for many years, over 30 years, and one day a stranger comes walking by, and the stranger, as he gets to the beggar turns to him and he says, "Sir, can you spare some change?" And he held out his cap to receive some money. And the stranger said, I have nothing to give you. But then he said, "But what is it that you're sitting on?" And the beggar said, "Oh, it's just an old box that I've been sitting on for many, many years." And the stranger said, "Well, have you ever looked in the box?" And the beggar said, No, there's nothing in it. It's just an old empty wooden box. There's nothing, no point to look inside." The stranger said, "Have a look inside." And so the beggar did, and he found, to his astonishment, disbelief, elation, that the box was filled with gold. Now, Tolle tells that story to make two points. The first is that there's nothing good outside of ourselves. See, the box represents, in this story, represents what's inside of us. And he was saying to the beggar, "You never looked inside where all the gold really is." There's nothing good outside of ourselves, and everything that is good is found on the inside. And I would just suggest that we, and you may be doing this, but we contrast this story with that of Peter and John and the lame man, where they said, "Silver and gold have I none, but what I do, I will give. In the name of Jesus, rise up and walk." The healing, life answers come from outside of us, from the Christian understanding, not from the inside. This seems to be the prevailing answer to the question of what is good today. There is nothing objectively good outside of ourselves. Therefore, goodness is whatever I want it to be, and personal happiness is what most people say that they really want. What is truly good? According to the National Study of Youth and Religion conducted by the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the faith held by most American youth today includes the idea that the central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. What is good? It is to be happy. Since there is nothing that is always good or is always bad, then what we have to look for is what gives us the most happiness. The motto of this age, therefore, is be yourself. Be true to yourself, because that's where happiness is. You deserve to be happy, and happy is whatever you want happy to be. Personal happiness is the highest good, and we call that individualism. I would suggest to you that a reason we've moved so far, so fast as a culture on divorce and remarriage and homosexuality and gender identity issues is because we have elevated personal happiness above any recognition of universal wrong. This elevation of personal happiness to the supreme good influences us. It influences professing Christians. I understand that the Christian music megastar Amy Grant, in defending her divorce, said that she knows that God hates divorce. But she's also realized a more personal and freeing truth, and that is that God wants me happy. What is good? What makes me happy? Paul says, do not allow yourselves to be molded by the worldview of this age. And I've just painted three pictures, three components of that worldview for us today. Relativism, there is no universal truth. Naturalism, the physical is all there is. And individualism, the individual and his or her happiness is the highest good. The worldview of this age is powerful. It will shape us into its mold without us knowing it even happened. It'll change our thinking and convince us in the process that we're free thinkers. The worldview of this age is pervasive. We can't escape it. Advertisers are convinced that they can shape the buying habits of a nation, and they have the numbers to prove it. Talk radio, newspaper, Facebook, the internet, Twitter, neighbors, all have a conforming influence on what we think is true and what we think is valuable. The worldview of this age, of any age, really, is like a tsunami. Do nothing, and we will take the shape of the dominant culture. Merely live defensively, retreat, put up our walls, we'll be washed away. A tepid, half-hearted response to the spirit of the age will not form a generation that is aligned with the beliefs and values of the kingdom of God. Don't be conformed, Paul says, but where is the strength to overcome this overwhelming force?